Well, I was asked to talk about a very big idea, honed down to how it really is for very ordinary people, the spatial structure of London and how you can provide affordable housing within it. I'm going to be very, very honed down. London does not have a spatial strategy. It has the River Thames cutting it north to south, and it has the City of London and the Lee Valley cutting it east to west. And these are very different segments of the city. So in the west, we've got all the posh things and all the palaces and all the really important rich things. But we've got a very overpressured, overpriced city. We've got a place where a lot of people don't feel comfortable, and we've certainly got a lot of people who just can't be there and do anything there. It doesn't belong to them. That's quite important. On the east, we've got the opposite scenario, and if you just got a train from Fenchurch Street across the river and up the road here, 15 minutes down to Barking, you'd see just how dramatically different that city is. A city where industry has left its heavy footprint, where there's dumping, power lines, gasworks, a derelict port, very poor housing, swampland, low value, low density. Very, very difficult to rescue, only 15 minutes from the city. So I tried to persuade the people who work with me to go and look at housing in Barking. It's half the price of the centre and a quarter of the price of the West End, and they will not go and look at it. Why? All of these problems. But it does have this mixed communities dynamic, and it's incredibly good value, and in the end it will be where families go. And we're doing some work on that, which I'm going to talk to you about in a minute. But London, within those two kind of complete contrasts, is under immense pressure compared with the rest of the UK, as you can see. It's on a totally, totally different trajectory. And we've done this work with the 2001 census to show who are the high flyers in urban Britain and who are the low flyers. The high flyers are only basically London and a few smaller non-metropolitan cities, Oxford and Cambridge, for example, or York. You can stray north occasionally. And the rest are the north, the Midlands, and the other big cities. So there's a huge, huge divergence, which I think is unsustainable. And it's basically reflected in the wider regional trends. So population drift from all regions north of a sort of line from Bristol to Lincoln, and huge bursts of growth within the whole of the south. At the same time, the minority concentrations are a very big issue, and I would like to take issue with Tony a little bit. It is true that ethnic minority populations are dispersing everywhere. So almost all districts in the country now have some ethnic minority population, but 44% live in only 5% of the districts in the country. And if you look at London, this simply reflects all the non-pale blue is where there are at least 25% ethnic minority populations within the city, which obviously is, as many people have said, is one of London's huge strengths. But as I'll show from what families are saying to us, families of all ethnic origins, it's hugely pressured too. So if you live in the East End of London, in the eastern part of London, there are certain things that are going on that are very positive. The East End is gaining in wealth and status. The transport links have been completely transformed by buses. It was always poor because it didn't have the trains, but actually now it's got buses. Small terraced homes and warehouses have become the it place, the kind of housing you really want, unlike in the north where we're still knocking them down like there's no tomorrow. And the thousands of old council estates are massively gaining in value. So tenants on many of the really poor estates are fighting like hell to stop demolition because they're affordable homes. And on the other hand, developers are trying to grab them as very extravagant sites for regeneration, but then what happens to the people? And within all of that, some main streets, such as, for example, Stoke Newington High Street, are absolutely booming. But Barking Town Centre's really still struggling. So you've got this really sharp dynamic going on. And we are talking to 200 families year on year on year. We've been doing it for 7 years now, about what's good and bad about where they live and how it feels to bring up a family in the City of London, particularly its East End. They're very torn. About 70% of them want to move out, which is a terrible indictment of how the city treats low-income families, but most can't move out. And many are actually torn, even though they say they want to move out, because they've got family ties and because they've got community ties. So it's a very sort of difficult picture. So we try to kind of get at what really makes them feel so torn. And there are lots and lots of good things about these poor neighbourhoods. They're much friendlier. They report much, much higher levels of friendliness than other parts of London or other cities. They like living in mixed areas. They like their neighbours. They like being near things. The buses are great. Lots of facilities because it's the city. They can't usually afford them, but they want to join in. So anything that's a street festival, and remember, every street festival is completely different. So the idea that that is like dumping council estates that are identical is a bit of a misjudgment too. They want and like community spirit. So whereas in Britain, on average, 50% of us say that community spirit matters, among these families, 90% say it does, and they want to influence things. But lots of bad. They do like living in a mixed area. They do like being in a global city, but the change is too fast. They don't know who's their next door neighbour, and there's too much underlying racial conflict, as well as a whole load of other things that you can see. Among the very, very big things they hate is they can't influence anything. They want to influence, they like influencing, but they can't. And there's not enough for kids and young people. So they're very, very reluctant to condemn the trouble that they face as families because of disorderly young people. They say there's just not enough for them to do, and the public safe spaces aren't safe. And then they say that there are some things that are good and bad. Schools are very, very, very good, but not good enough. They don't actually help them get on as far as they should. The parks are a huge asset. They've got children, but they're not usable because they're not safe. Community relations are really important to their life, but they can't really make them work because they never know who their neighbour is. And they like mixed neighbourhoods, but how much mix can you really cope with? And the black tenants say, these are about 80% tenants, by the way, sorry, say that they don't want white people to be chased out, and they feel that they're chasing out white people. I think that's a really, really important and telling thing. And they say that these areas are very resource-rich, but resource conflicts because of the population pressures are huge. So given that all of this is within the Thames Gateway, and both of the areas where these families are very close to the Olympic sites, I think it's quite important to link the government's huge growth area regeneration plan for the Thames Gateway with what these families are saying. So, you know, the Thames Gateway going through huge growth pains, jobs, housing, roads, massive timescale, trying to do in the East End of London in 15 years what was done in the West End of London in 1,000 years. Huge scale of spending and building, but serious transport limits, ignoring existing communities very, very rarely, and you'll notice in the presentations that you get, very rarely in the big plans is there any mention of how you actually build around and within existing communities. These sites are sites of existing communities. What you do about the floodplain threats, and are the Olympics really key to London's future? Does it really need this huge boost when it's already under so much pressure? I'm not saying it doesn't, I'm just asking the question. And then the other side of it is that the Thames Gateway isn't the equivalent of the city to the edge of West London. It's the equivalent of the edge of the city to Oxford. It's a vast, vast, vast area of non-city. And so if we allow it to develop in the way that is currently being envisaged, for example, with the huge Eastern Quarry development, with a rapid transit link into the City of London that actually circulates around the edges of all the existing communities, then we're really stuck. There'll be lots of short-term job losses through development. There are very heavy environmental impacts that the Environment Agency, the government statutory body, as our custodian, is saying simply cannot be coped with at the moment. Very big security questions that a couple of people, well, Anthony particularly, raised that aren't being addressed. These families live in fear of their streets. They want to be on the streets. They need their streets, but don't be, and certainly don't let their children out on them. A very unequal resource division. Other cities in the UK, the Manchesters would kind of give their right arms, not to be the Olympic site, but to have a metro link, for example. And Are we in danger of valuing space for the short term rather than the long term? And are we sufficiently valuing social space? And I think Nikki's point about national child play areas as opposed to national car parks was a very well-made space. So density becomes absolutely critical to our future because it's the only way that we can get proximity between different communities. And if we can drive the funky side of East London, so that slightly better off people densify East London, these families would be over the moon. To the extent it's already happening in the inner East End is actually something families praise. And I think the environmental imperatives would fit around that. So we have to have stronger incentives to use space carefully, and one of the things that our government is constantly avoiding, we have no property taxes at all in this country, and we do pay a council levy for council services. One absolutely obvious way of redistributing both the population and the density and the wealth of London is to have property taxes on a steeper step with more gradients, so that better off people over occupying space would actually help the crowded families that are intensely pushed into tiny spaces. And that in turn, I know it sounds a little bit crude, would combat isolation, because one of our biggest problems is you become rich when you're older and no longer have kids, and you then have a big house and a second house and access to all sorts of luxury hotel spaces and so on, which actually creates this kind of fragmented, isolated society that leaves old white people stranded within rapidly changing minority communities in the East End, where the parents and children are scared of letting their children out and don't know how to help the old people. So we've got this kind of frame of distress that could be a very, very different story if we looked at making London a series of communities where all of these things, which I haven't got time to go through, unfortunately, could be made to work. The most important of which is the top line. London is a city which is stuffed with very small spaces. We only count in our planning system spaces down to 2 acres, which is about the size of a football pitch. Below 2 acres, one inner London borough has enough spare spaces to produce all the housing that the entire City of London produces in a given year, roughly 25,000 homes. So if you replicate that, and if you acknowledge that small sites appear all the time, they replenish themselves, you could actually constantly rebuild London within those small spaces. Have I got 30 seconds to show pictures?
Quick, 30 seconds.
I just want to show one neighbourhood of London which can't build. It's completely full. It's where the Arsenal football ground is, where infill sites have been used to amazing advantage. So there was a garden, a very big garden, at the end of this kind of quite dense street. New house you can see being built in it. And at the back of it is the house that was there, which had been derelict for 20 years, now being converted into 6 flats. The street next to it, all of those were garages. They've been turned into 3- and 4-storey houses. A council block opposite those derelict garages that was in a terrible mess has been sort of renovated, but in a very modest way, so it's still social rented housing, but extremely popular with kids using this area all the time. Little spare derelict site in this unbelievably pressured neighbourhood, probably worth about £1 million, now actually being built on, which is great. An old church that I didn't want knocked down, and Simon Jenkins would be very upset if he knew it had, but turned into a church, a community centre, and 2 flats at the top. 2 garages turned into 2 more houses. 2 old toilets turned into 2 houses. Highbury Corner, massive traffic jam heading for the A1 and the M1, most popular tower block in Islington. An old warehouse that used to store sugar and flour for the local stores been turned into flats. Another old warehouse turned into flats by one of the highest density estates in London. So there we go.
Very good.